I flew in this afternoon from San Francisco Airport to here, and as I was sitting on the plane, a stewardess came by and offered, you know, would you like something to drink? And I said, some water, please. And so she poured me this water, and she started to hand it to me, and then she got distracted and turned her attention to something else. Speaking of directing attention, she directed her attention elsewhere, and she had just trusted, I suppose, that she was actually going to make contact with my hand, which was there for the water, but in fact, she missed my hand, and I got a little bath. So my shirt, my pants, and the New Yorker I was reading. Of course, I had a little moment of like instructing her in mindfulness, but I didn't. And it was a fairly dramatic sort of miss. But it was only water, and it was not going to make any difference. So, to speak to her distress, I said, you know, this was just water. Once I was flying from New York City to Spain, and I had hurt my back so I could barely get on the plane, and I was sitting in a middle seat in the back of the plane, and for no reason whatsoever, I had a Coke sitting on my little tray. And when I say no reason whatsoever, there was no like put your trays up in a lock secure position. There was no announcement like that. The stewardess just came running by and flipped up my thing to close it and threw this Coke all over me. And so here was this sticky Coke all over me for many hours with my back hurting. And I said, so this is nothing. Her response was, it sounds like you're unlucky flying. This was a moment. And I said, no, actually, I've flown hundreds of thousands of miles over decades now, hundreds of thousands a year in some instance, and I consider myself very lucky. And she goes, oh, well, I guess that's good. I didn't tell her about the time that I was on a plane flying to London, and there was a credible bomb threat, and we put down in Nova Scotia. I didn't tell her about the time flying up to Maine from Tennessee, where it got so the icing thing stopped working, and we barely were able to see to land. I didn't tell her about the time flying from London to New York that something went wrong with the landing gear, and we flew out over the Atlantic and dumped all the fuel and came back and all of us in the crash position landing. I didn't tell her about the time flying from Bahamas to the US where the radio signals went out. So there was no, this was at night and something went wrong. This was on a small plane in that instance. I didn't tell her, most scary of all, about the time that we were flying from Tennessee again in a small plane. My friend had a small plane. And we'd foolishly gone on, and there had been a hurricane passed through, and there were huge headwinds, and we went ahead anyway and ran out of fuel. And we were over the New Orleans airport and could not, it was fogged in. And the person flying, I was sitting co-pilot, and don't fly at all a plane, said, we have to land. We have to land. And so they put the runway lights up and the full thing they do for kind of crash kind of landings like that. And we passed three times. And the third time, my friend said, you know, I have to put the plane down, and whatever we get is what we get. And just at the very last, you know, 20 feet or something, the runway was clear. It was that close. That was a very fortunate situation. So if you ask me, I have been extremely fortunate, very lucky flying, as a matter of fact. And those times flying were times of uncertainty. There were times that arrived that's uncertain. Every time we get into complicated situations in any kind of a moving vehicle, there's a degree of uncertainty. Some are more uncertain than others. These were particularly uncertain times. It was not clear what was going to happen. It was just not clear at all what was going to happen in these situations. And there's any given one of them, I can tell a very funny version of it, a very dramatic version, all of these different kinds of things that happened. Sometimes there was someone very upset involved in all this, very lots of hysteria. So I could make a big story out of all of these, but that's the story. The phenomena was the uncertainty of outcome. That's the phenomena. In those situations, very, very fortunate. So we live now in a time of uncertainty. We have had an event happen in our country around the election that however you voted, there's no question that there's a time of uncertainty. It doesn't matter whether you voted for our new president or didn't vote for our new president. Either way, we have a time of uncertainty. And there is reason to understand that for individuals, for groups of people, and maybe for our whole country, there is some amount of genuine danger in this situation. This is part of life. This is part of life in a democracy, and how a democracy, the way ours is situated, can lead to this result. I'm going to address this. I'm going to open this up a bit in terms of how we utilize the Dharma to perceive, receive, respond to times of uncertainty where there is varying degrees of danger associated with this uncertainty. We will talk about that at the end of our time here. But I want to do it in the context of what the evening's offering was in the first place, which is that of a bit of reference to the Satipatthana Sutta, which is what we will be looking at throughout the weekend. Just for my knowing, how many of you are going to be here for the Friday, Saturday and Sunday? So about a third or fourth. Okay, thank you. So, the Satipatthana Sutta is a sutta that is a map for practicing mindfulness. It's a set of directions. It's a set of directions that I think are incredible in usefulness, and it's the architecture of it, the thoroughness of it, and so forth. But it's a subjective set of directions, and I say this because you may have your own version of the Satipatthana that you evolve as you practice, and you may not find some pieces of the Satipatthana to be that useful to you or whatever it may be. But it is a map, it's a set of directions, it's an architectural description, it's kind of a blueprint for mindfulness. And this weekend we're going to be largely focused around what are called the four prerequisitions or prerequisition mental factors for practicing mindfulness. That's a very small part, but a very essential part of this relatively long sutta or teaching of the Buddhas. So that's what we're going to do. I'm only going to touch on that very, very briefly this evening, and then we'll go into it more this weekend. So there are four Satipatthanas, these four foundations, it's sometimes called, sometimes baskets it's called. People have different ways of describing these four aspects of our experience that the Buddha delineates for us to look at our experience, a way of parsing our experience so that we can see it more clearly. These four satipatthanas, in my view, build one upon another so they become ever more subtle, but each is equally valuable in the sense of being worthy of mindfulness in the same way. So again, as I was saying about your own experience, as however we divide experience to know it more deeply, each is to be treated with equal degree of respect and interest and curiosity. The first of the satipatthanas, after a description, this introductory description of what the whole thing is, the Buddha turns to awareness of the body. And that, to me, is significant, that the foundation, the building block for knowing our experience is knowing our own body. Knowing our own body. Knowing our own body not as concept, but as a felt experience. The felt experience, as I directed in the meditation, knowing the body as it feels. And a part of there's a number of different exercises in the different ways of knowing the body. One is the breath, as we did tonight. One is the elements, knowing the earth, air, fire, and water. One is knowing the parts of the body. There's a number of different ones. The body and its mortality way. All of these different ways of knowing the experience of the body. Always as a felt sense of it, knowing the body in the body, such that we have a direct understanding, not one more conceptual overlay. This is one of the beauties of the Buddha's teaching. He uses our mental capacity, and he will inevitably have to use concept, but he's not having us grasp of or identify with concept, but go through, see through, live through the concept to the direct experience, to directly know, to know for ourselves. Therefore, it's not a belief-based system, but an experience-based system. Someone came up during the break and was talking about how important a practice was to her as she is dealing with a major health problem. And that's what she did constantly in this very challenging situation, was just go back to her practice. This made the Buddha smile, wherever the Buddha is right now, because that is the instruction, to go directly to our experience and to know the experience. I talked about presence because mindfulness leads during the meditation. I was wanting you to notice how in hearing, that if you start to know, it's not just that hearing is bringing you into the moment, but as you, that this knowing that you're knowing, and knowing that you know, that it brings a deeper and deeper layer of relationship to the experience, a fullness of our cognitive, perceptual, intuitive knowing to the experience, so that the mindfulness becomes a deeper and richer experience. Very important, this knowing we know. We're really present if we know we know. We're no longer just knowing an object. We're knowing our own capacity of mindfulness, our own capacity of awareness. Does that make sense? Anyone a question about that? I'll give more time for question afterwards. So in starting with the body, we are knowing the body in the body. In the body in what way? In the felt sense of the body, and the sense of directly knowing the body. In terms of the breath, we know when the breath is long, not as a concept, not as a label, but a long inhale feels like this. A short exhale feels like this. We know the experience of it. And this is not the Buddha's language here, this knowing we know, that's my language of this. We know that we know, therefore we have faith, we trust, we're willing to be available to the experience in the immediacy of the experience, in the immediacy of here and now. Almost always, we're a little afraid to fully be present. So we're a little pulled back, or we're a little pushing at experience because we're so uneasy with this moment because we don't really know what's going to arise in the moment, and certainly we don't know what's going to arise in the next moment. So we naturally and not unskillfully at the time, from childhood on, we developed a little holding back or a little pushing in. We're dealing with it somehow, pushing and pulling at experience or hovering. Mindfulness in its fullness, we're willing to show up for whatever's there. Whatever it is. The body may hurt. The body, we may, when we show up in the body, we realize that, oh, you know, I've got this uncertain disease. I don't know the outcome. It's uncertain having a body. It's fearful having a body. The Venerable Sumedho will say when he's teaching a retreat that to be born is to be given a death sentence. That's very frightening. This is the first noble truth. It's very frightening. And therefore, the ego, to protect itself, to not, it would naturally like hold back, hover, all of this. Very natural. But as we gain the benefit of our mindfulness practice, of our concentration practice, of our metta practice, our compassion practice, we realize, we discover slowly, intermittently, we forget, we grow more in some areas than we do other areas of being willing to just be with our experience, but we come to be able to be with our experience. We're just there. It's pleasant or it's unpleasant. It repeats itself on and on for a period of time, or it doesn't. It's just a moment of experience. And we know that it's just a moment's experience. And we know that we know. We don't have all these little thought things that I'm repeating over and over again now. I'm doing this to point out what we either already know or sort of know or will come to know, and recognize that in some ways we've always known it anyway. And it all starts with this mindfulness of the body, the awareness of the body in the body. And this is the first satipatthana. You've practiced this a lot, those of you who have an ongoing practice that you've come to hear to Sims or go to on retreats, or residential retreats or day-longs or whatever. We do a lot of, in our particular lineage, we do a lot of awareness of the body practice, and it's a very good practice. It becomes being in the moment, a way to be in the moment. We come into the moment through the body, and that leads us to the second satipatthana, which is that awareness of the feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And so how do we recognize that? Well, we start by recognizing it in the body. This moment of being aware of the body is pleasant. This moment's unpleasant. Oh, knee pain is unpleasant. Oh, feeling all warm in a cold day is really pleasant. Oh, pleasant, pleasant, pleasant. The body really feels pleasant. But then it keeps getting warm. Oh, now being warm is unpleasant. So we start to see that the pleasant and unpleasant, we start to see its changing nature. And most profoundly, we start to see how it affects our attitude. We see how the arising of this little small flavoring of pleasant or unpleasant will control what our mind does. Unbelievable. That this moment that we know, if we think about it, we know it's going to change anyway, but we can get furious because it's unpleasant in this moment. Someone stepped on our toe in the supermarket. Someone poured water over us in the airplane. If without a trained mind, it's unpleasant. But if we grab hold of that unpleasantness and we act out of that unpleasantness, do we get pleasant coming from that? No. We get more unpleasant. And yet, because it's so strong, that's what we will do. This is called the reactive mind. The mind is reactive based on the condition of pleasant or unpleasant. And we see this just in the body. We have to have some reference in which to... we can't have the second satipatthana till we have some reference. We have to have a first satipatthana to be watching. We have to have some place to see pleasant and unpleasant arising in relation to experience. Thus the body first, and then the scene of this pleasant to unpleasant. And the great thing about the body is that we are more willing to be with the body, and it's more palpable to us, more directly experienceable than like mental activity. It's very hard sometimes to know in a mental activity whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or exactly what it is. Even we don't even know what mental activity, what emotional activity is going on. But with the body, it's pretty clear, oh, this is pain or this is not pain, or it's kind of neutral. So very brilliant, this structure. And so we then see that that in relation to experience of the body, that if we grasp hold and all, we start to see what happens. We see the power of pleasant and unpleasant and what's wise and unwise. And one of the things we see eventually is that even the pleasant, if it's grabbed hold of, is suffering. This is counterintuitive. It's counter to how we're biologically wired, because of course we want the pleasant for survival. But in fact, on the more subtle level, it is dangerous. If you're out on the savanna and you've just killed some sort of an animal that you're going to then take back for the tribe to eat, and you're sitting there being all pleased with yourself, the lion who was tracking that same thing goes, this person's taking my food, taking my dinner, and we missed it because we were so pleased with the pleasantness of this thing. So even in a biological level, there's reason not to trust the pleasant, to not grab hold of pleasant. Not out of a neurotic fear, not out of hyper alertness, but out of a mindful alertness that would track for survival. We see it more, of course, ordinarily in our own wanting minds just around little things. In a current situation, we may want to not have to deal with uncertainty. We want the pleasantness of not having to deal with uncertainty, and that can lead us astray. So we again, just starting here early on, to see how all of this applies. The third foundation, the third satipatthana, the third basket of experiences that are lumped together, are the mental states that arise around emotion. And there's the Buddha delineates a series of them having to do with whether the mind is filled with wanting, filled with anger, whether the mind's distracted. And we learn to notice two things about that. We learn to notice when it is both present and when it's absent. And this is very important, a kind of understanding, because when the mind does not have wanting, if we notice the mind doesn't have wanting, this builds faith. It builds this knowing of the well-being of not being caught in wanting. So it's not just noticing that, oh, when there's wanting, it's painful. We notice we have a direct experience, once again, of seeing, oh, there's not wanting. It really feels good not to want anything. And how many times do we fail to notice that? it will create a strong sense of well-being if we start to notice this. The absence of wanting, the absence of anger is the same way. It really feels good to have a calm, clear mind. It really feels good. It's not a big super high, but it is such a rich experience. And we, over time, realize I would rather have this calm, clear mind than the soap opera of it's great and now it's horrible. That in fact, there's a way of relating even to our love, our passion, everything, that this sense of calm and clear relating to our experience is more rewarding than the identifying that creates the soap opera of these huge ups and huge downs. And I know for some of you, you're going like, what ups? I know about those downs, but what ups? And yet they are there, and it can be at times much more up or much more down, but it's the soap opera is all this up and down of identifying with the pleasant or unpleasantness of body and of mental emotional states. And so in the third Satipatthana, we see this. So I've talked about what we see, but really in these first three Satipatthanas, the practice is what's called bare attention, so that we know our attention is on the body enough to know that there is a body. We're knowing the experience. This gets a little complicated because they all get integrated together, so there's not separate. But for our practice sake, we're not first trying to have a lot of insight about awareness of the body. When we're aiming our attention for development purposes, we're establishing our attention on the body. We're being mindful of the body. That's it. And we can't help but notice all these things. But our goal at that moment is really like knowing the body, being able to be present in the body. And that's when we're directing attention just to the body, not in choiceless awareness when we're or the fourth Satipatthana, but we're just knowing the body. And then we're just knowing pleasant and unpleasant so that we can really know it. We can know it as the felt sense of each of Satipatthanas. So that's what starts out developmentally as a progression, as a development process of mindfulness. We are establishing these strong enough so that we really know how to turn our attention that to know pleasant and unpleasant, so it becomes habit. So if something's really pleasant or unpleasant, we automatically notice it. We don't go, now, what is it, those Satipatthanas? What's that second one? Oh, it's too late, you know. It's never going to happen. So we do a kind of practicing scales. On the piano, those of you who know jazz, the circle of fifths, where we learn what resolves, we have a feeling sense for what will resolve, a minor to a major and that sort of thing. It becomes automatic. We don't have to think, now how do I get out of D minor to some major chord? It's too late at that point. In playing a tune, you practice scales, you practice the circle of fifths of doing these kinds of fancy chords so that you do know it's the same in practicing the Satipatthanas. You're knowing each of them in their own sake before you make your piece of music. Makes sense to you? And then we come to the fourth Satipatthana, which is the Dhammas of all of our experience. The Buddha's teaching of how to parse experience of the body, parse experience of pleasant and unpleasant, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, and parse these mental, emotional states of mind so that we see them in Dharma terms. And we see them in Dharma terms over and over again to the point that we are able to see them not from the ego's perspective alone, but from wisdom, from the heart's compassion. And so our experience gets filtered, it gets enhanced by the truth of the Dhamma, which we can all see for ourselves. Again, you're not supposed to believe this. You're supposed to practice. See for yourself. A.E. Pasico, come see. Come see. A.E. Pasico, come see what's true. This is the Buddha's invitation in his teaching. It's not a, now this is the way it is, and you believe this, and if you just believe this, everything will be fine. Nah. Come to direct experience in this way. And so as we do that, we start to see all these things for ourselves as we're seeing through the Dhamma. So our whole range of experience that are there in the first three Satipatthanas, then our whole range of experience is viewed, is known, is penetrated through these Dharma teachings, these truths of how it is. All of our experiences, these three are laid out there, then they're penetrated with the wisdom, the compassion of the Dhamma. And that's the fourth Satipatthana. Not always described maybe so directly this way. I have, last 2 years ago, I taught with the Venerable Anadio, who wrote this wonderful book called Satipatthana, and who has subsequently written a second book in which he goes back through the same thing he did in the first book and examines it from three sets of existing Buddhist teachings, the Theravada and the Chinese and Tibetan and all these different ways of looking at it. I always advise people to start with the first book. Would not be his preference, but for us who are more slow grasping these things, understanding these things, to start with the first book. It's a wonderful book. And I basically assisted him 2 years ago, and I will be assisting him again in a retreat in April, which opens for registration in a couple of weeks, by the way. It's a wonderful retreat to attend. He is so impressive in the way he presents this material, and equally inspiring in the way he sits. He sits there for hours as everybody comes and goes. Like, he'll sit there for 3 hours in the morning, and people come in for the sit, they leave, he's still sitting there. Very, very inspiring. It sort of raises your own sense of what's possible. So I recommend this retreat. But when he teaches this, he stresses that there are certain of the dharmas that are that he believes are more essential than others in terms of this understanding the truth of our experience. Again, these first three Satipatthanas being our experience, and then the fourth Satipatthana being the Dhamma of these, the truth of these experiences, seeing them from a Dharma eyes. And one of the ones he stresses is seeing the hindrances of mind. Most of you probably know the hindrances quite well. If not, if you just stay around any time at all, you're going to hear about the hindrances, and that because they're so important, they're so useful in terms of being able to find freedom from getting caught in things. And then the second of these is the aggregates of our experience, what makes up a moment's experience, which I won't go into tonight. But again, you will hear about that as the five aggregates that make up a mind moment. And then the third is the awakening factors. What are these certain traits of being present that help us be able to see what is suffering and what is not suffering, and being able to choose non-suffering over suffering. These are called the awakening factors. And they start with mindfulness, and then they go through various other things on investigation and calm and all these different factors that would be too much to go into tonight. But we can learn what each of these factors are, And we can have a direct experience of each of these factors, such that we know these, we know when each of these awakening factors are present, and we know when they're present, and we can kind of play the scales of them. We can utilize them together. We learn how to bring one up to balance out these awakening factors so that we're able to dance with life in this way that brings about, at least in this moment, the end of suffering. And then there starts to be new habits of way of relating to experience, so there's less tendency for suffering to arise, because much of our suffering is from habits of mind or old conditioning. And those old conditions in the mind get really lessened, and those old habits of mind get replaced with new habits. And so that we start to see, wow, this practice really works. And then the final part of the four satipatthanas is the realization of the Four Noble Truths. So everything that starts with just awareness of the body is building the whole time for us to realize the Four Noble Truths. It's so beautiful that this is true in this way, this completion, the wholeness of the practice. At the same time, there's a paradox which initially irritated me when I experienced the part of this teaching of the four foundations of mindfulness, the four satipatthanas, the four baskets. And that is that there are these so-called prerequisites, these mental qualities that one is to bring when one is practicing mindfulness. And they are having diligence, having clear knowing, having mindfulness, and having a mind that's free from desire and discontent. Well, when I read that, I did not want to read. My first number of years of practice, I would not read anything, because I did not want to get a bunch of conceptual layering into practice. The idea of direct experience made total sense to me. That I discovered that's what I had done in my Raja Yoga, which I'd done quite intensely for 10 years before I ever turned to Vipassana. And I did not want to get a lot of concepts. So I had not read all of this, but at some point it became appropriate. It seemed appropriate to me to study suttas and all. And when I read this, I was going, but if mindfulness is necessary for practicing mindfulness, and I don't have mindfulness yet, how does this work? You know, this is a contradiction in terms. You know, if I was already mindful, then I would need to practice the four foundations of mindfulness. But over a period of time, and we will talk about this a lot in the weekend, we learn that each of these qualities are developed as we go along, so that they become part of our essence. We have free access to diligence, to this kind of commitment, this enthusiasm, that by stirring it up as we go, it later on becomes a natural part of us. Or said another way, we come to that which was already in us, but which we did not have access to. So we cultivate it, we act as though, we create conditions for it to rise, so that we reach the point where it is just there for us. And the same with this clear knowing. Clear knowing has so much depth to it that I can't even start to touch it tonight. The Pali word for this is sampajana. Pajanti is wisdom, and sam is with wisdom. And so we're practicing mindfulness with wisdom. because there is mindfulness that's unskillful. And as mindfulness moves more and more into the secular world, this is something to remember. Because if you're the most mindful person in the room, and everybody is in this room in a committee meeting trying to get what they want, the person that's most mindful has an advantage of getting what they want. You're mindful. Oh, you see, if I say X to person Y, he's a fear-based type. So if I bring up fear, he'll stay away from that object. Oh, this person really gets excited if I talk about how we're going to win. So I'm mindful, I see that they really respond to that. Oh, well, I'll just paint this picture of our winning, and I'll persuade this person. That's being mindful of in a certain way. But this is not the mindfulness of the Buddha. The mindfulness of the Buddha is not to create more productivity. To be a better worker is not the mindfulness of the Buddha. Maybe it's good to create a mindfulness that leads to more productivity, but that's not what we're studying. The mindfulness of the Buddha is to be able to choose, to be mindful in such a manner that we can recognize suffering, recognize the absence of suffering, and have the wisdom and the compassion to choose non-suffering. That is the mindfulness of the Buddha. It's the mindfulness that's part of the Eightfold Path, which is the Fourth Noble Truth. I use every opportunity to bring this up and say this because I really want to remind us all in our community that we are involved in a very ancient practice that has a specific goal and a moment-to-moment intention. So I, those of you here this weekend, you'll hear me do it again. I really want this to, I want to contribute what little bit I can to this staying alive. Because in our society, we monetize everything. We commoditize it. We did this with the ancient tradition of yoga, which is to a large degree turned into a commodity that has lost its referencing to its deeper wisdom that's there. It happens with everything. It's the nature of our culture because of the way. So it's, if you want to claim your own freedom, you have to claim your own freedom. Your co-guiding teachers here are here to help you doing that at Sims and all the other people who teach here. But we always, in the end, have to claim it for ourselves. And so it is with the diligence, with the clear knowing, the mindfulness, and then this mind that's free from desire and discontent. We're, as best we are in any given moment, we're inviting these qualities of mind to arise. But we don't mind if they're not very strong, because it's just a moment of practice. My mind's jumping around all over the place. And is that worse than when your mind was calm? Which is the better practice, when it's easy or when it's hard and you're starting over and over and over again, over and over and over again, and there's no reward? Is that less practice than when it's easy, when it's going well and it's really rich and, boy, rewarding? Which actually builds the muscle of practice? I would argue both. And I certainly wouldn't say, oh no, just good practices. On a pleasant level, I prefer good practice. I liked it tonight when my mind was all calm and the breath and not interested in anything. That was much more pleasant. But when those complicated thoughts were coming in and it was juicy and the stickiness was arising, that was less pleasant. But my sticking with that and my staying with the stickiness, the complicatedness, seeing its pull to me, wasn't that not equally as valuable as that moment of calm and peaceful? So we start to see how the four satipatthanas are ways of practice, not ways of resulting. So easy, again, in our culture to get falling over on the resulting and not staying back into practicing. It's taken me longer to do this than I had hoped to do, and I apologize for that, and we'll keep us on schedule. So how does this relate to our present situation? Our present situation is one of uncertainty. No matter whether you're an enthusiast about the present situation or not, we're in new ground. We're in new ground in my lifetime. We're in new ground in many ways, in anything in the last 120 years. We're in some ways in new ground, period, for various reasons. This is uncertain. How do we meet uncertainty? We meet it with mindfulness. We meet it with compassion. What does compassion look like? We're careful not to other anyone. Part of the reason there's so much fear right now is that many people feel othered. They've been made the other, the alien. That word alien, you know, that seems like much more insidious than it first may appear. You go, why is that so upsetting? Alien is a big word of being made other. So you may be one of those people that feel othered, but not to respond with otheredness. So just being careful about that, being careful not to make someone inferior in some way, just because they voted differently, they have some hope for the future that's different. Now, I'm not talking about people who have hatred in their hearts. I'm not talking about that, because the election was won not by because some people had hatred in their hearts, but because people felt alienated in just the way that we're talking about, feeling othered. And so we don't want to contribute to that. Likewise, we don't want to collapse. Tomorrow or the next day, I'll talk much more about how we meet the moment without collapsing. But we want to watch ourselves collapse into despair, collapse into withdrawal, and rather than stepping forward, meeting the moment as best we can. When we meet suffering, that we meet it. We respond with whatever resources we have. Sometimes it's only in compassion. Sometimes it's going on a march. Sometimes it's picking up the phone and calling a senator or a House of Representatives, or giving our resources, giving our time, our money, just recruiting, whatever it may be. Again, from whatever point of view, I'm not talking about a point of view here. I'm talking about the feeling in our society right now. Sometimes it is being that balancing when someone's really upset. Sometimes it's when someone's got a lot of fear, it's saying, I am here for you. Sometimes it's learning for yourself the resources that someone's here in the country illegally without papers in that way. It's being able to say, well, this is what you can do. There's this group and this group that help people in your situation. You may not be part of those groups, but you are informed. You inform yourself to have a wise response to someone's fear, if you see what I mean. So we do all of this by treating this moment of uncertainty, this moment of despair or fear, if that's what you're feeling, or if it's you're feeling the other way, really convicted, like, yes, now it's the way I think it should be, it's going to happen. You may well be in for a lot of disappointment yourself. In whatever your experience, to say, I wish to be mindful of the experience, but not just mindful, but this wise mindfulness that I just defined earlier, that has compassion. So it's a compassionate, mindful intention of meeting whatever is arising currently in a way that is that has wisdom and kindness and responsiveness in it. That is how, from our practice, we would meet this time of uncertainty and fear. This compassionate, mindful intention. Compassion, the heart's involved. mindful. There's a deliberateness and of intention, mindful of what, of meeting this way, that there's no, that we're minimizing the suffering, and that involves this responding with clear comprehension, responding in a way that leads to wisdom, having wisdom in how we respond, helping others find wisdom, helping others stay in their body when fear is popping them out of their body. Popped out of our bodies is not very useful for staying calm and like figuring out, well, what do I do here? What do I do if they show up at my work tomorrow? You know, that this, I'm staying embodied so that there's a way to have choice, to be able to reflect wisely, to not be in this reactive mind. So that's how I would say, in this short way, of talking about how we respond to the moment, utilizing the four satipatthanas. I was hoping to have time for questions, but I really don't, or any of this. I'm happy to stay here for a few moments if anyone wants to come up and ask anything or say anything. But I'm going to keep us all on schedule as a group, just to honor our social contract in that way. So this will then conclude my part. Tim's going to be coming back for a few announcements and all, and ride sharing and such. You are a wonderful group of people to share an evening with. Every year I say the same thing, that I'm here. But the reason I come back every year, because it is a schlep to do this, and I could teach locally and not have to get on one more plane and stay in one more hotel room and all of that. But it's worth it to me because I so honor your community, your center, and your individual practices. So again, thank you for having me.